The reading tonight is from Ecclesiastes, and it actually says on the newsletter that it's three chapters, but you were pleased to know I'm only reading little verses from each rather than all three chapters. You'll find the reading on page 642 if you wish to follow the verses in the Pew Bible. So it starts at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and that's starting at verse 13, and the section's entitled Wisdom Better Than Folly. So verse 13. I also saw under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Now there lived in that city a man, poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. But nobody remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. And then moving on to Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 1. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honour. And then jumping down to verse 10 and 11. If the axe is dull and its edge unsharpened, more strength is needed, but skill will bring success. If a snake bites before it is charmed, the charmer receives no fee. And then verse 20. Do not revile the king even in your thoughts, or curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird in the sky may carry your words, and a bird on the wing may report what you say. And then lastly, over the page to Ecclesiastes 11, verses 6 to 8. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let your hands not be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. Light is sweet, and it pleases the eye to see the sun. However many years anyone may live, let them enjoy them all. And thank God for his word.
Thank you, Carol. So this evening we come to the penultimate in our series in Ecclesiastes. And you would think I would be better at organizing things. I have no idea how I ended up with 2.5 chapters to do in one evening. And you've heard of the reduced Shakespeare company where you can do the whole of Shakespeare in a couple of hours. Well, I'm not going to try and do that tonight, but I hope that we, as we open it up, we can at least get some understanding from these passages. And in particular, I just encourage you to, you know, take them home and read them again, because you'll discover a lot more just by repeating that exercise. In a way, the teacher, the writer of Ecclesiastes, finally has got to the point where he feels the need to become a bit more practical. He's had this long-running theme of vanity, of vanities, all is vanity. Now he tells us that wisdom helps make a life. Or if you prefer, he points to wisdom for living. Where can we get these practical things that will make a difference? I just hope that as we open it up and as you perhaps contemplate on the passage afterwards, that you will ask the Lord to nurture qualities of wisdom in your own lives, that you might find it for yourself. So, wisdom for living. There was a small city with few men, and a great king came and surrounded it and constructed siege works. He threw up soil and earth against it so that he could climb up the walls. But there was a poor man who lived there, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man. Poor, wise man outsmarts a great king. He saves the day, yet he's unrewarded. He's unrewarded with wealth. He's unrewarded even with social esteem within the city. And the sad truth is that wisdom is often only sought at desperate times. Otherwise, it's only those who have wealth and power and position and influence who are able to demand public attention. Think about those that demand public attention in our country, those you see in the newspapers and online and on the television. They're not necessarily the wise. They're often the influential, the wealthy, the glamorous. And although this wise man failed to personally profit from his labors, his wisdom was not profitless for others, nor was it profitless for his world at his time. And this poor man's wisdom impressed the teacher. Remember, this is a teacher who's attributed often to Solomon, who searched out wisdom. Where can I find it? Where can I find it? And he found it in this poor man that nobody recognized, nobody remembered. And he was greatly impressed. And he drew some conclusions from it. He concluded that godly wisdom is greater than strength. Wisdom is better than strength, he says in verse 16 of chapter 9. It's very interesting. As we get older, as we advance in years, we lose our strength. I think it's true of most of us. I do know one guy who's 90 who goes to the gym every day of the week and seeks to preserve his strength. But we lose our strength as the years advance. But the wonderful truth is that we can gain wisdom as we get older. We trade our strength and we gain wisdom. There was a strong young man on a building site, and he kept bragging that he could outdo anyone on a feat of strength. He was one of these kind of arrogant, strong kind. And he particularly focused on one older workman. And he didn't like the older guys at all, but there was one that he particularly didn't like. And he kept going on about it. And this older guy finally snapped and he said, "Why don't you put your money where your mouth is? I'll bet you a week's wages I can carry something in that wheelbarrow, cross the building site to that building over there, and you won't be able to carry it back." This young guy says, yeah, here's my, I'll put the wages up, I'm happy. Let's go for it. I'll show you, old man." So the old guy, grabbed the wheelbarrow by the handles. And he turned to the young guy and said, "Get in." Okay, I know it's a bit corny, but the truth is that wisdom may not always bring accolades and popularity, but it does tend to win the day. Our church here has a lot of amazing ministries, all sorts of different types of things that go on. And we rightly recognize those who work hard to make it possible, week by week, month by month, to make these events and ministries a reality. But we need to continue to appreciate those who are older and wiser. Those who have laid the foundation for these ministries over many, many years. The prayers and faithful servants of many older and wiser Christians in this church who have remained committed to this fellowship, to this community. And it's them that have made the present ministries possible. And we must never forget the debt that we owe. That debt to those who served for many years and in many ways. And we need to find ways to express appreciation for the wisdom that God has placed in the midst of this church, in the midst of this community of believers. In spite of any arrogance we may feel, the abiding truth is that God's wisdom is greater than man's mightiest strength. The passage rolls on. I don't have time to go too deep. Sorry. The next bit says, avoid foolishness at any expense. In the midst of praising wisdom, of extolling its values, the teacher turns and warns us of the dangers of foolish behavior, and he repeats it over and over. Read the passage, you'll see he repeats it over and over. I remember as a young Christian reading Ecclesiastes and always being bemused by it, and especially when you come to chapter 10, verse 1. Dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, to use one translation. So a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. And it's not particularly a pleasant thought. I don't know how many of you are wearing perfume this evening. I just hope that no flies got into the preparation of what it is you're using this evening. And it's interesting because it vividly illustrates how a tiny bit of foolishness can destroy the powerful fragrance of a person's dignity and reputation. It destroys that foolishness. It destroys the fragrance of someone's personality, personal dignity, reputation. A fly in the ointment. We have all these lovely sayings that come out of the scriptures. It takes far less effort to ruin something than it does to create something. It's easier to make a stink than it is to create sweetness. Flies are insignificant creatures in the overall scheme of things. A perfumer's oil, on the other hand, is a very costly substance created with care and skill. And yet the insignificance can spoil the valuable. One fault, one unchecked, one secret sin cherished can poison a person's entire character. Perhaps it's a bad attitude, maybe it's a bad habit. Perhaps it's a tendency towards being irresponsible or unreliable. Maybe an omission of something that we really should be doing that's not corrected. All of it can lead to spiritual deterioration. It's easy to think, oh, it's just one little insignificant thing. But we must remember that a little thing can ruin everything. And frankly, you should swat that little fly before it lands in your perfume. Just take the thought home. Swat the fly before it lands in your perfume, before it leads to spiritual deterioration, before that small thing starts to destroy what is so valuable, so attractive in each of us. And then the writer gets even more practical. And then in verse 4 of chapter 10, he says, when your boss gets angry, just deal with it. Just deal with it. Never let another person's actions determine your reaction. Just hang in there and deal with the person. Keep your cool. Maintain your composure. Calmness can lay great offenses to rest. Do not abandon your position. And we've all worked with difficult people. I could give you my long list. I know some people, oddly, think I'm difficult. Never quite understood that. But there are contrary moments, I confess. And our reaction is usually, I don't have to put up with this. I don't have to put up with people like that. I'm just going to get another job. I'm going to quit. I'm going to go and find somewhere else to live my life. Yet, the truth is that there are difficult people everywhere. You go find a new job, a new place. New place to live, maybe. And you know what? There are difficult people there, too. And you haven't really escaped from them. And the teacher advises us to calm down, to breathe. Don't give up. Don't run to a new place trying to run away from a broken world. We must all recognize that there will always be difficult people. People that we find difficult to deal with. Maybe they're not difficult at all. Maybe it's us. But they are difficult from our perspective. And these people might well be in our own family. They might well be at work. They might be our next door neighbor. They might be at school. You could easily find them in church as well. And you could always leave and go to another church in the hope that there are no difficult people there. It's easy to get angry and frustrated. It's natural to wish that people that clash with us weren't part of our lives. But there's an interesting truth in this, that without them, our life would be so much easier. But without them, we may well become spiritually flabby. We might just become spiritually flabby. Because of them, we are forced to grow in areas that would otherwise remain undeveloped in our spiritual lives. And the teacher urges us to avoid foolishness at any expense, because ultimately foolishness destroys our lives. Then come to a section where we get some clear statements about wisdom is for living. And there are four concrete ways in which we can make that wisdom work for us. How to apply wisdom to life in this section of chapter 10. So I'm going to do them quickly because I don't have time to dive in. But if you read them, you'll see them. And I'll put the four of them up at once. First one, apply wisdom in getting a job done. So you're really strong, you get your shuffle, you dig a pit. You dig a huge pit, a great big useful pit for something. I'm not sure what, but you dig this great big hole and you feel really good about it. But if you're not careful, you'll fall into it. And the chances are if you fall into it, you're going to hurt yourself quite badly. You might even, depending on how big your pit was, you might even die. If you break through a wall, there might well be a snake on the other side. If you quarry stone, and I don't suppose we're out quarrying stone much, but if you start breaking up stone with a hammer, the chances are you might get hurt by the bits that fly off. If you split logs, because you want to break them up to burn them, the chances are that it might come back and hurt you. If you've got an axe and the axe is blunt, you're just going to have to work harder and harder and harder to do whatever it is you're doing with that axe. You can have all sorts of energy and gusto and perseverance, but you need to think before you act. Think about what you're doing. Avoid the perils of your own work. Be wise as well as energetic. And if you don't have enough wisdom to sharpen your axe, then you're just going to have to work much harder. You ever tried carving meat with a blunt knife? Not only does it take a lot of effort, it makes a terrible mess of the food. The only thing you can do is say to your guests, I'm not very good at carving, when the truth is, we never got round to sharpening the knife. Stop. Sharpen the edge. It's much better to work smart than it is to work harder. Use wisdom in controlling your words. It's quite a talent to be able to charm a steak. Blowing the old whistle, have you seen it? Maybe some of you have travelled and seen the real thing. But if the charmer gets bitten before the snake is charmed, his talent as a charmer isn't actually going to do very much good. You need to use the wisdom you have, or else that wisdom is useless. You might as well not have it. And the same is true of our words. It's easy to multiply words. But there are actually many advantages to silence, to saying less. There's wisdom in leading others. We see that in verses 16 to 19. Some leaders trying to solve problems by having great celebrations, having big events, by having fancy meals. But the teacher says, we eat to live. We don't live to eat. Somebody who can control the kind of basic appetite and have control over the hunger are likely to have control over other areas of their lives, areas that take self-control. And self-discipline is crucial in a leader. We are affected by the tone of those at the top of any organization or country. This is true of good leaders, it's true of bad leaders. And no doubt, lazy, incompetent, or simply moral failure on the part of any leader, and therefore the organization or country they lead, will ultimately lead to its collapse. And it's true all the way from the White House through Downing Street, through County Hall, through the District Council, to our house at home where we live. Unless there is a discipline, unless there is wisdom in taking the responsibilities that we have. If you read the passage, there's a really interesting section there that gives you the image of somebody with a can of beer in front of the television watching football, drinking, while the beams sag on the roof and the water starts to fall in, and as the house falls apart and they open another can and drink some more beer because they're not disciplined, not leading the family in the way they should. And last one on this list of four is applying wisdom to withholding criticism. It's interesting that we get all these great sayings from the Bible. But this particular one, the teacher says, the wise person doesn't criticize someone even in the privacy of their own bedroom. That room that's kind of the personal space. Don't criticize someone, even if they're people who have authority over you and they're obvious fools. Don't criticize them, because a little bird might fly off and tell what you said. A little bird told me, is our expression. We even speak about walls having ears. Don't criticize, because it is inevitable that that criticism will go back. There was a politician, not very famous, it's not surprising really, and he said that among one of his most prized possessions were the words that he had never spoken. Among his most prized possession were the words he'd actually never spoken, even though politicians, you know, their role is to communicate and engage. Can we recommit ourselves tonight to holding our tongues? Will we strive to believe the best about people? Will we refuse to participate in gossip? And if someone wants to talk to you about another person, just close down the conversation. The truth is, gossip and slander can destroy friendships, it can destroy communities, it can destroy families, and it can destroy churches. You think you've been surprised by Ecclesiastes, and then you turn the page and you discover independent financial advice. Diversify your investments, says the teacher. I just don't kind of quite expect this. Since life is so uncertain, spread your financial investments out, it says in the beginning of chapter 11. And when you do your trading, don't put everything in one ship, put it in several ships. And don't send it out all in the same way or at the same time. Because if you lose one of the ships, one of them sinks, you won't be ruined because there'll be other ones. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Diversify your portfolio is the message. And don't leave the ship safely in harbour. That doesn't work either. It has to set sail. Because if there's no risk, there's no reward, says the teacher. Don't play it safe. Take risks. Any number of financial misfortunes could and most likely will occur. We know that. That's the reality. And in light of that, we need to be prepared to the best of our ability. God's expectation is that we will invest whatever resources we have, whether it's money or other things, that we'll invest them wisely. He has given us money. He's entrusted us with possessions. And we should be looking for the best means of using them. It doesn't mean putting them on the stock exchange or anything like that. Perhaps that is what you should do. But the thing is, how are you going to use them? Are you using your mind? Are you using your ability? Are you getting the right advice? Don't go for any quick rich schemes because they don't work. They just don't. The biblical view comes down to this. Since God alone knows the future, we ought to make our plans, plant our seeds, invest what we have, use our brains, study the situation, take all the factors into consideration that we're able to do, seek wise counsel from others, do the best we can, and then leave the results to God. Then leave the results to God. Don't be reckless, because there's the path of certain ruin. But don't sit on your hands either. And then I thought to finish, I had to lift the evening. Carpe diem, carpe diem. Do you know what that means? Seize the day. I'm not very good at it. It's Latin. I never did Latin at school. The school I went to didn't do Latin, so I didn't get the chance, really. It invites us to take life by the horns. And the reason we should do this is summarized in a slightly less well-known Latin phrase, memento mori, which means remember you are mortal. Remember you must die. And put together these phrases of human wisdom, encourage us to live life to the full while we can, to savor life while it lasts. This morning, when introducing his sermon, Graham said that he'd been asked to preach on several subjects in the evening that he found difficult. And one of them was to remember you will die soon. And he was ever so pleased this morning that he had a better subject to preach on. So the combined wisdom, if you like, the human wisdom that come from those two Latin phrases summarizes the message of Ecclesiastes 11, 7 to 10, the second part of that passage. But with one alteration, God is added to the mix. Light is sweet and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. Even those who live for many years should rejoice in them all. Yes, let them remember that the days of darkness will be many in the future when we're dead. All that comes is fleeting. Rejoice, young man, rejoice, young woman, while you are young, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Follow the inclination of your heart and the desire of your eyes. But know that in all things God will bring you into judgment. Banish anxiety from your mind. Put away pain from your body. Don't be hidebound by the suffering that you have. For youth and the dawn of life are fleeting. No matter what stage of life we are currently experiencing, not many childs, not too many youth here tonight. Perhaps we are mainly adults, middle-aged, perhaps a little older. This passage encourages us to live life joyfully. We are invited to enjoy life, to enjoy it realistically and responsibly, to bask in the sun while never forgetting we dwell in the shadow of death. There's something about the realism of this second half of Ecclesiastes 11 that's an interesting combination of good news and bad news. Half is incredibly optimistic and positive, and the other half is brutally realistic in its acceptance of our bodily decay, the inevitability of death, the reality of divine judgment. And this juxtaposition of good news and bad accurately reflects life in the real world. Our experience of life is not all good, neither is it all bad. Instead, it's something in between. It's a combination of glorious beauty and unspeakable brutality and suffering. And to deny either the beauty or the brutality, would be deceptive, would be unrealistic. And if you go all the way back to Ecclesiastes 1, chapter, verse 1, it's something the teacher just wouldn't allow. Life is good. Truly, life is beautiful. All the ugliness of sin cannot hide this fact, so rejoice. We need to hear this invitation to joy. We need to be reminded that life is meant to be enjoyed and not merely endured. We're called to thrive, not just to survive. We can celebrate each day, each hour, each moment for all the good things that come. The sunlight, the air, the color, the smells, sensation. The list is endless. They're a gift from God. Certainly the world is full of sin, but it's also full of joy as well. And faith embraces God's gifts. It enables us to enjoy them. It enables us to smile at life. Christians are not called to be pious drudges. Let me say that again. Christians are not called to be pious drudges. Faith is often thought of as in relation to troubles. Faith overcomes. Faith is triumphant. Faith shines through the ashes of affliction. It's all true. But faith also smiles. In verse 9b, we're encouraged to follow the inclination of our hearts, to chase our dreams. We usually counsel young people, young men and women, to be disciplined and extremely cautious out of fear of youthful waywardness. But this counsel, well-intended as it might be, is simply too safe. Too safe. Life is more thrilling. Life is more wondrous. It invites us to dream, to risk, to dare. Opportunities abound in youth, and we should encourage young people to exploit them to the full. The teacher isn't endorsing a carefree life of self-gratification and reckless pleasure-seeking. Such foolishness would give in to youth's illusion of immortality and indestructibility. But the teacher is inviting young people to take advantage of the unique possibilities that being young offers. He calls them to fully develop their gifts that God has given. This could be the most productive time of their life, and it shouldn't be wasted. And the teacher's final encouragement to us is to lighten up. I know it's a modern expression, I'm sorry. Lighten up. Not to take our lives, ourselves, too seriously. To banish anxiety from our mind. To put away pain from our body. He does not wish us to be crushed by the excessive responsibilities and their accompanying worries. Feels like a time, we don't have time, but it's a time to reflect on the beauty of life, the fleeting nature of time, the inevitability of death, sure, and the reality of divine judgment that we can face with confidence. But may our reflections lead us to carpe diem, the reality of our mortality, of divine judgment, and life's brevity are not meant to discourage us, but to spur us on, to seize the day. This is the teacher's desire, that we would nurture rather than suppress the vitality of life. When you think about this, could I encourage you to ask the Lord to teach you prayerful wisdom, to protect you from any inclination to foolish actions? Ask for his wisdom in the current decisions that you need to make, because we all do that. Ask him to nurture qualities of wisdom in your character, so that you might be more like him and more able to enjoy every moment of life that he has given us, confident that we walk in his way. Amen.